disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest with now.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128 been war, you play Nintendo on some shooter, so put the bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s. Write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs every bridge that ain't been burned. For every cop car that ain't.
Welcome to This Is America, May 24th, 2019. In today's episode, first we talk with several people in the Atlanta, Georgia area who recently were arrested for protesting the conditions within the DeKalb County Jail, which It's Going Down has covered in the past. After arrest, they soon found themselves inside the very institution they were protesting. We discuss their experiences and the broader campaign. We then talked to several people involved in the relaunching of the Inari's Info Shop in Portland, Oregon, and talk about the role of space and infrastructure within the wider movement. During our discussion segment, we talk about recent attacks by the Trump administration on immigrants, trans people, public housing, and beyond.
I'm an extremely stable genius. Okay.
Discussing the history of neoliberalism and also tackling current headlines. All this and more, but first, let's get to the news. McDonald's workers in cities across the U.S. went out on strike this week over demands of $15 an hour, the right to form unions, and against sexual harassment, with 25 women in 20 different cities filing suits against the burger giant. The strikes and walkouts caused 10 stores to close in St. Louis, while workers in many other cities picketed and walked off the job, according to the Wall Street Journal, which described the strike as one of the largest disruptions of the fast food chain in 10 years. In Mancos, Colorado, around 25 people came out to protest ICE and the detention of two community members who had been working at a local Mexican restaurant. Lyft, following the global strike of gig economy drivers and their disastrous IPO rollout, has now moved to slash drivers' pay per mile, in some instances as much as 25% of the previous earnings. The sixth child since September has now tragically died in Border Patrol custody. Meanwhile, the McAllen detention facility in Texas, which grew infamous after photos of children sleeping outside with just thin metal blankets went viral, and now has locked down itself in quarantine after a flu outbreak. In St. Paul, hundreds of students walked out of class in response to two teachers' use of the N-word in class, prompting one of the teachers to resign and the other, a substitute, to be fired and sent home. Across the U.S., mass protests have been organized against a wave of new attempted abortion bans. And in Salt Lake City, Utah, people rallied and camped outside of the police station in response to the police killing of Cody Bellegarde. Ultimately, however, the DA decided not to charge the police officer behind the killing. Members of the Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement, or RAM, responded to a call from the jailhouse lawyer Speak for a week of action around the theme of Fuck 12. Also in Kentucky, a series of Confederate statues were also vandalized in solidarity with the call. Officials in Dayton, Ohio, as was the case of so-called leaders in Charlottesville, Virginia, in the buildup to the Unite the Right rally, are telling residents to stay away from the downtown area in the lead-up to a planned rally of the Ku Klux Klan. Members of the Klan negotiated with the city in order to secure a permit, but agreed only to allow registered members of their official organization to come to the event, which numbers only around 20. Over 1,000 counter-demonstrators are expected to mobilize. One of the Vaughn 17 has been found not guilty for the charge of murdering a guard, making him the most recent inmate to be found not guilty in the case. Finally, the viral craze of milkshaking, or the pouring of a tasty lactose beverage over someone in an attempt to shame them, which has been used against members of the far-right party in the UK promoting Brexit, has now reached US soil. In what is guessed to be Kentucky, someone delivered up a creamy malt to a member of the neo-Confederate group the Highwaymen, a group of paramilitaries which attended Unite the Right and was seen protesting outside of Planned Parenthood. The Highwaymen were also one of the groups which attacked a rally of trans youth several weeks ago at the Kentucky State Capitol. As they say, revenge is a dish best served cold. And now for some upcoming events. On May 25th, there is the mass mobilization against the KKK in downtown Dayton, Ohio. On May 30th through June 3rd, there is the Earth First Regional Rendezvous in the Hudson Valley. From May 31st through June 2nd, check out the North American Anarchist Studies Network Conference hosted in Atlanta, Georgia. Also in June, be on the lookout for Running Down the Walls events happening across the U.S. to benefit the Anarchist Black Cross and other prison abolitionist and anarchist groups. On June 12th through the 19th, there is the Save the Mattole Direct Action Convergence in Northern California. On June 14th through the 17th, there is the Fight Toxic Prisons Conference happening in Gainesville, Florida. On June 15th through the 23rd, there is the Wild Roots Feral Futures Gathering in Southwest Colorado. On June 19th, there is a mass mobilization against the National Solutions Conference in Tennessee. On June 29th through the 30th, there is the Southern Regional Organizing Assembly of the Industrial Workers of the World of the IWW in Richmond, Virginia. On August 3rd through the 11th, there is the Institute for Advanced Troublemaking Gathering happening in Worcester, Massachusetts. And finally, on August 16th through the 18th, check out the Indigenous Anarchist Convergence happening in so-called Flagstaff, Arizona. That's going to do it for us. As always, enjoy the interviews and the discussion, and we will see you soon. Okay, we are joined here today with four people in the Atlanta, Georgia area. We're going to be talking about an ongoing situation in DeKalb jail right outside of Atlanta. On the program, we've in the past had somebody whose mother had somebody inside. And since then, there's been a series of demonstrations outside of the facility. The facility has tried to block the number to the Anarchist Black Cross in Atlanta for people to call in. There's been numerous people arrested, including the people that are joining us today, and they're going to be talking about kind of what they saw inside. But first, just give us a rundown of what's been happening in the past couple weeks, and generally just tell us a little bit about what's going on.
Okay, so the campaign started a little while ago, back when someone's mother, by a man named Darnell, held up a sign saying the, please help, what is it, please help we dying, on top of these plastic trays. This got viral. This is the campaign, this is how the campaign started. And since then, we've kind of been building up to, we had been building up to this kind of big action. There was a big one that happened back in April, where four people got arrested. I don't think he's in this right now. And then after that, we were then building up to the May 15th action, where I believe all three of us in this call are arrested at.
Okay, just for people that that didn't listen to the past show, essentially just people are being put into jail like they are across the U.S., you know, for minor traffic infractions, getting pulled over. And they're getting stuck there, and the conditions are very horrible. There was photos that came out of people holding up signs. They were trays, meal trays that said, yeah, we're dying. Talking about the food, mold, just the conditions in the jail are pretty horrific, and people have been protesting those. So let's talk about, so you went from people on the outside supporting inmates, and then all of a sudden you yourself were inside. So what did you all see?
All right. Well, basically I was arrested on the 12th, and the four of us were taken in and put into like one of the little holding cells, and that was packed with other people. And yeah, as soon as we got in there, like the door opened and everyone that was already put in the holding cell were like yelling at the guards, asking for water. They wanted a sandwich. Like that's was the immediate request. And after like 5 to 10 minutes of sitting in this holding cell, they pulled everybody out, stuck us in another one, and I guess we waited around a little bit longer. They stuck us back in there. The cell had obviously just been cleaned. Like it was filthy when we were put in. And they brought in water, they brought in sandwiches, and the guys in that holding cell were like, yeah, we've been asking for that for hours. Like just now this protest happened, you people came in, that's the only time they paid attention, only time they cleaned things up. But that was a pattern throughout the stay there.
My story was kind of different. When we were arrested, three of us were put together in one holding cell, and we sat there maybe 6 hours, 6 or 7 hours. It's hard to keep track of time when you're in there. One thing I did notice when I was sitting in there, just while waiting, that all of the walls had been like, all the places I had been in had been freshly painted. Like the paint had gone on there fairly recently. And I remember hearing stories coming out of the jail that certain wings had been shut off so they could basically paint over the mold. for example, there was like scratching on messages and stuff scratched into the wall that they had painted over, and you could tell that the paint had kind of seeped into the crack and maintained the message, or like something had been on the wall that had been painted over, and you could clearly tell that the places that were where myself and another comrade had been put in there had been put there specifically because it was one of the nicer spots. And even in our cell, there was water covering half the floor of the cell.
Another thing we saw in intake this most recent time was just guards casually threatening to kill prisoners. There was another person in intake, and one of the guards got in an altercation with them and was basically, you know, provoking them, saying like, you know, hey, you don't have to wait till you get out of here. You can come at me right now. Nobody's going to stop you. But if you want to come at me when you get out, I'll put 16 in your chest. And all the other guards, you know, treated that as something that was like normal or totally fine. And, one of the other guards even said like, oh, that's like making me really horny or something. You know, and it's just like, it's like that immediate, just threat of brutality, as soon as you get in.
I was one of the four people arrested on the 15th. I was the only person kept in the women's side of the jail. I was kept in a holding cell for probably about 4 hours. The one that I was in was really filthy. There was only one other person in with me, until I was stressed out and transferred into one of the pods. There were like kind of like half eaten pieces of bread and cheese like thrown around on the floor. There were a couple of styrofoam cups for getting drinking water, but they were all like very obviously dirty. I also noticed that the walls had been freshly painted. And I was asked if I needed to see the intake nurse before processing. I said no, and they told me that I needed to see the nurse anyway. And their position was kind of first pandering to me in a way where it was like, oh, like you wound up in like the wrong crowd, or you're like too educated to be here. And then when I wasn't receptive to that kind of treatment, they were really aggressive and just tried to try and like mess with me psychologically. They were talking about how they were going to change the charges that I had, and that I'd be spending a lot of time there. They said that I exhibited signs of violent behavior, and so that I was going to have to be kept away from other inmates and guards. And then I was put in a cell by myself until receiving a cellmate at around 4 a.m. And the cell that I was in, there were a lot of mostly religious messages written on the underside of the top bunk. It was really cold, and people had tried to kind of plaster over the vents inside with wet toilet paper. There was dirty like pieces of paper and styrofoam cups and forks with dried food on it and dried vomit in the cell that I was in. That sort of thing.
Let's talk a little bit about the food. I know that has been one of the major problems that people have stated, is the food is moldy, it's unedible.
Yeah, the food there was just generally disgusting. I didn't personally experience mold, but judging just from what other people had said, like, you could taste it in there, you eat it, you get sick. And, I mean, you receive the tray, and you have to take a minute to process what's even on there. I mean, it's mostly just mush, maybe like rice, some kind of weird bread. Like, the meat is just pretty much completely solid. I mean, you get plastic utensils, like, there's really no way to eat it. And yeah, it was just disgusting. I'm sure other people can corroborate.
Yeah, So I've actually had jail food before in a different context, and that food was marginally edible. This food was not. There was something wrong with the bread. I can't quite place it. It was not edible. I barely ate while I was in there. Certainly. Yeah.
I gave up my food to other inmates while I was in there, who said that they'd been hungry and hadn't been given enough to eat for the weeks that they'd been in. But when they served breakfast at around 4 a.m., I think, the guard that was giving out the trays said that there was something wrong with the bread and they didn't have time to remake it. And so the pieces of bread were all stuck to the bottom of the trays above them. And the guard said to just scrape it off of the bottom of your tray and eat it.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Did the guard say anything to you? I know some people mentioned they were kind of, you know, talking shit. This is pretty general. You know, you go in, especially for some political thing, and they're going to say something or, you know, like just make up some story or try to scare you. But did they say anything else? Obviously they knew why you were in there.
Right. I had the guards kept calling me up towards the glass facing the tower. And they were just kind of like prodding at me. Like they were like, do you feel tough without your big group of friends here? Like you think that the conditions are so bad, like you get to see it for yourself this time. Mm-hmm. They're definitely like some of the people who I spoke with, that were kept in like the men's part of the jail, like people were aware of what had been seemed like they were more aware of like the actions that had been going on and were maybe able to see that from the part of the jail that they were in. That didn't seem so much like the case in the women's side, not in like the pod that I was in anyway. Like out the windows, you could only see the wall of the other tower. And I did hear one inmate saying, after they'd gotten off the phone with their cousin, late the first night, that they just figured out that it was because of a protest. But they said that, one person said that they'd just been watching two guards that had semi-automatic weapons on the rooftop for the past 6 hours. And they, from that section anyway, you couldn't see the street directly in front of the jail. And so it was just this strange kind of disorienting experience.
I could say that there's definitely a culture of just lies in that entire facility. Initially, when the four of us were arrested, like on the 12th, they thought potentially we could get out the next morning. They told us, you're going to have court at 9 a.m. And we were being transferred from the holding cell to the pod at 9 a.m. So, of course, we expected, okay, they'll rush us over there. No. The next thing comes up, you'll have court 1 p.m. That doesn't happen. They say 5, then they say 9 p.m. And of course, all that just rolls past. None of that happens. And this was a Saturday. We asked, okay, are we going to have court tomorrow? Sunday morning, they say no, no court Sunday. So, we're expecting, okay, we're just going to sit in here another day, get out Monday. And then basically first thing Sunday morning, everyone's called to court. And that whole process is put in place. It's just the entire time you're in there, they're playing mind games and lying, and you just don't know what's going on.
Yeah, something like that happened to us while we were in there on the men's side. So it was a very, very strange scenario. Basically, two of us were put in a pod together, me and a friend, and then another one of us was separated. The following morning after we had been detained, what happened was, the one who was separated, who's with us, and the one I was with, who's not with us, they were both pulled aside to go to court, and I was left behind. They didn't tell me why. They just kind of dragged everyone off. They all went to the thing, and I was just left behind there for a few hours. Then later, when everyone got back, I was told that our warrants had not been written up yet, so we couldn't be given bail. So we had to wait till the next morning. then a few hours later, we ended up being released without any kind of ceremony or anything. We were just let out. It was a very, very strange scenario.
Yeah. So what they told us, when we were seeing the judge, which it was just like a video, a Skype with the judge kind of thing. They were like going through the women first, and then, there were several women, including, one of us who had not been called before the judge or whatever, and they're like, oh no, you don't have warrants written, so you just have to leave and see you later. And then they started going through some of the men, and then they, one of the guards came over and unlocked, two of us who were there, and took us out and didn't explain anything until we were out in the hall, and then he was like, you know, you don't have a warrant written, so you can't get bond, so you're just gonna have to wait until tomorrow. And, you know, apparently, they say that the arresting officer has, you know, 72 hours or something like that to write the warrant. And that you can just stay in there until they write the warrant. So it seemed like very deliberate also, retribution, that they were trying to, you know, we were directly, calling for closing the place where they work, right? So they, probably felt threatened or defensive about that, and seems to be retaliating.
You know, where do you see things going from now? Like, where do you think things to either really change, or for more people to get involved, where do you see things kind of, what's the next step?
Well, I think yesterday we spoke to a woman that had literally just gotten out of jail moments before, and she mentioned that on the 15th, during the protest, you know, pretty much everyone inside ran to the windows in support, and they were, you know, banging on the windows, and they were locked down by the guards for 24 hours. And I asked her basically, like, how did you feel about being put in lockdown over something that we did on the outside? And she said, like, honestly, I wish we could have busted out and come out there with you. Everyone in there was in solidarity with what was going on. And in terms of going forward, we have to continue to maintain a presence outside of the jail, listening to what people have to say. Like, there's so many people in that community, like you said, that have either been in there themselves or their family members are in there currently, family, friends, whoever. And we have to build support and solidarity in this community, because, I mean, they're being beaten, oppressed, and thrown in that place every single day. So we just got to keep the momentum going and listen to the people that are being affected by it.
That is all. I would agree with all of that. I also think in terms of just the tactics in regards to the response of the outside behavior, like our behavior on the outside, is that it's going to be a matter of escalation. Like, they came out from the get-go with this and on the 15th. Like, they were prepared and they came out in force. And it's very likely it's going to probably get worse for the people on the inside significantly, and for any response that comes from the outside probably. And we have to keep showing. We have to keep them on their toes, and we have to keep showing support for the people inside, because they're the ones who matter, and they're the ones who are fighting the hardest, who have the most to lose from all of this.
Majority of the people, all of the people that were arrested on the 12th are white males. And we were put in there being the only white males, really. And this is just another example of the continuation of, like, the white supremacist agenda, and how it's being just so efficiently executed on these communities. And yeah, I mean, it's the four of us were, it was abnormal for everyone in there to see that, and it's sickening that this is continuing.
What kind of conversations did that bring up?
Yeah, I know when we were put in the holding cell, everyone in there was, like, really curious about, you know, what had happened. And, I mean, as soon as we let them know, like, we were protesting outside because of the conditions of this place, we want this place shut down, again, they were just completely in support. And, you know, there were people that I personally had conversations with later. I mean, there was a kid in there. He was 18. His brother just gotten out. He was in the same car. It was another brother of his, like, being shot in the streets and just, like, watching him die. And I let him know. He already knows. He's grown up in it that, like, you're being targeted. And I don't know where to go with it. Black people of color in there, they know that it's messed up, and they're appreciative that at least somebody is trying to make a change, because they're just being beat down and killed and just thrown in that place.
For the first day or so, I didn't say a lot to anyone, just because that's kind of who I am. But leading up to us actually being let out, the reason why we were in ended up kind of coming out. And the moment that happened, like four or five guys in the room got really excited. Like it was very clearly a very big deal to them in that way. Like one guy kept like hurling compliments at me. It was actually really uncomfortable. I don't know how to take that very well. And I kept trying to say that like, it wasn't about me. It's about everyone on the inside. And I guess like, that day was pretty rough for me. The following days were as well. But one of the things that kind of carried me through was that this is very clearly important to a lot of the people around. It was very clear from the people I talked to, that this means more to them than the fact that people care and visibly show that they care means a lot.
Yeah, people know that they feel like they're forgotten, and a lot of them are.
Yeah, I had the experience where like my soulmate initially, when we first woke up, like kind of threatened to fight me, and then over the course of the day, as I like told him about why I was in there and like what we'd been doing, like he was really into it and really supportive. And there's kind of an enforced like silence, like they have a TV blaring and like everybody's just super tired and like traumatized. So it's hard to like, sometimes it can be hard to talk, but like with everyone I was able to talk to and talk about why we were in there. And also like then after we were like taken away from the judge without being a chance to get bond, then I like told them about that. And I was like, ah, that's so messed up, you know? So then when we finally got out, like everyone was like locked in their cells when I was able to walk out, but I like threw up a fist and some of them threw fists back. So people were into it.
Thanks for coming on and talking about this. Everybody's aware of just how fucked up the conditions are, but definitely seeing people out on the streets was great to see. I mean, this thing is far from over, and there's jails and prisons across the country and beyond that are, have just as worse or worse conditions. Anything else that you all want to talk about in closing? Anything that you want to say in terms of the campaign or any of the groups that you might work with that you want to give a plug to?
I guess I'd personally like to give a shout out to the Atlanta Solidarity Fund. I mean, without them, some of us might still be in there. So if you're able, look them up, send a donation their way, because the work that they're doing around here is really crucial. And if these demos continue, those funds are probably going to be needed again.
Yeah, the Solidarity Fund and just like all of the people doing jail support like for these demos has been like a huge resource and like relief. Like while I was in, I wasn't given a PIN number to use the phone and like didn't have any numbers to call or anything, but like knowing that there were people like working on making sure that we would get out and like who would be there to see us when we were released was like a huge means of like I guess relief. Yeah,
I would encourage anyone in other cities who doesn't have like a local solidarity fund to think about how to start setting that up. But that's been something that's been really useful in Atlanta over the past couple of years. And then also like a lot of the ongoing campaign is being done through Atlanta IWOC. So if people want to follow us, they can follow on Twitter or Instagram, Facebook at Atlanta IWOC.
And I guess I'd like to also say in closing, just please get out there and talk to the people in your communities. Find out what's going on and just ask them how you can help.
have a responsibility to our children to make sure that the earth keeps turning. There's no need for to keep the oil burning, so I'm calling out a warning, yeah. This land is not for sale. The oceans are not for sale. The mountains are not for sale. Jah people are not for sale. So keep the oil in the ground. Keep the oil in the ground. Keep the oil in the ground. Yeah. Keep the oil in the ground. Keep the oil in the ground.
So just to get us started, tell us about how the Info Shop came about the first time around. I know you all are kind of like relaunching this project, but were you involved in the first iteration?
No, none of us were actually. That's the thing with projects, kind of like anarchist projects, is that there is this amount of turnover. And something that we're trying to kind of change about the project is to create it into this more stable, at least this is what I think, like a more stable, sustainable thing, that instead of there being a bunch of like kind of crisis things happening where, oh wow, like, you know, our rent is due and we have like 80% of it to figure out. It's the end of the month. And you know, just constant sort of things like that. We want it to be more of this, actual, like solid thing that people can actually rely on. For example, we're actually, calling you from the Social Justice Action Center, which, itself used to be called the Red and Black Cafe. I don't know if you've heard of that.
Yeah, it used to be a long running anarchist run cafe that was in Portland.
Yeah, yeah. And that was a really cool project. I remember when I first visited this, part of the country, I made a point to visit here because I had heard about it. Over time, I just feel like the projects that happen in the community, they run into these challenges with just having like reliable open hours, like these basic logistical sort of concerns. And, I don't know, like the reason why I've stuck with Anaris, personally, even though, there have been just a lot of annoying bureaucratic things to deal with, and just a lot of like logistical concerns that were kind of constantly unmet, is that if we just had some more stable spaces in the anarchist community, especially in Portland, I think that could be a really positive thing for both the city as well as just the anarchist community in general in North America.
I agree too. Like I've noticed, I've noticed, like anarchist things sometimes not be able to last as long, and it would be nice to have something sustainable. Though. And those are always good to have in the community. I remember coming to Red and Black Cafe a couple times and enjoying it. It's nice to have, you know, more things like that.
I actually, I've been trying to sort of streamline our online presence, so I ended up reading a bunch of older emails, and of course there's other collective members who aren't here who have been part of the project for a couple years, so we've talked to them, and we could tell you a little bit about the founding of the shop.
Yeah, for sure.
It started back in 2014. There was this group, this affinity group, I guess we should say, that decided to start the project, and just so people have some context for what Anaris is, if you don't get the reference, it's referring to a planet that was in the science fiction novel The Dispossessed by Ursula Le Guin, who's an anarchist or was an anarchist writer. We actually had a memorial for their passing at the old Info Shop location a little while ago, over a year ago at this point. But it's essentially like, What Anaris means in the context of that book is there's these two planets in the novel, and Anaris is one of them. Is sort of a very like statist, oppressive context, and Anaris is sort of this anarchist syndicalist planet. You could almost say, would you feel like that's, I don't know, an accurate description or so? Yeah. So it's basically like the idea is like, okay, this should be an image of the world that we want inside, of course, you know, like the old. And it's just supposed to be this literature space and a place for the community to come gather. We've had punk shows and political bands come to play, book tours and that sort of thing. That was the goal of the project, was to be that kind of resource and space for people. But at first, because it was created by this affinity group, I don't know any of those people, honestly, just because I came into the project years after this point and after people had sort of cycled out personally. But it got a reputation that it was this space for the affinity group. That was the impression that people had. And, you know, there was sort of drama associated with people having that perception. But what's funny is that it ended up kind of by the time that, you know, for example, in 2015 or 2016, it's no longer those same people who are involved with it. It's just this project that's kind of keeping going. There's a couple people involved with it at any given time. And it became something else entirely, right? Because it's just a different group of people. So I guess what we're trying to do is, or I guess what I would like to see happen with the reboot of Anaris would be to see it move not just into like a more stable place, but to kind of get beyond that sense that it's just for like an affinity group of like a certain group of people or a certain subculture of people. Something that the project has tried to do over a long period of time is to bring, at least, you know, since as long as I've been involved with it, is actually to push against this by bringing different subcultures together. So, for example, there was a peer-run needle exchange that operated in the same building as Anaris, which is itself a substance-free and more importantly, like an all-ages space that's accessible to everyone, regardless of what they do with that. So during certain hours where the info shop was not open, it was in the same building as this project that would show up on Saturdays and set up a space for, you know, people in the drug using community and in the houseless communities to feel safe and loved and welcomed. But it was also this substance-free space for like the rest of the time or during shows and that sort of thing that would be accessible to anyone who wanted to, you know, like come and be part of it. And there would be families and stuff that would come through. So it was tough sometimes to navigate, in my opinion, the contradictions that are rife in that, but it was very much worth it in a lot of ways. And I certainly feel like I grew and learned a lot from that experience of trying to navigate some of the beautiful things and some of the challenges that came along with that. And that's what I'd really like to see Anaris continue to do. Not necessarily that specifically, but to try and get people to understand that radical politics and anarchism can be this type of this space that people of many different subcultures, I guess you would say, or different lifestyles, or you know, different musical tastes can all be part of. That's something that's important to me, at least. But I don't mean to monopolize. Do either of you want to?
I agree. Like one thing that, you know, Jeremy is doing are is like first, you know, I know it's, oh yeah, there's shows going on and so and events and so I'd go to shows and you know, I'd come out from pretty far, but it was like worth the ride and I would have fun with that, and then I would check out the zines, literature, and stuff on the way out, and eventually, you know, I just kept going and became a member, and I agree, like, about with like, where things are going, becoming, like, a place where people can go for information, you know, and be, like, an info shop, you know, establish that again, while also having, you know, the space for shows to happen, it's like, that's pretty cool for it to be like So it's like bringing entertainment and education together, and so that's pretty rad.
Yeah, I'm just that I'm really excited about getting this new space open again, because like it seems like a lot of really rad shit is going on in Portland, and people want to get more plugged in. So
I just wanted to say one phrase that I've heard amongst multiple different people who are, you know, not involved with the project directly, but who are supportive or, you know, in related affinity groups, is that it would be really great to have an open, like, front office for anarchism in Portland. That's something that, you know, I think is very much needed, you know, just another radical space that can facilitate, you know, different groups of people coming into contact with each other and all organizing around shared struggle.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, because as the other person brought up, you know, there is a lot going on in Portland. I mean, everything from, you know, Burgerville to anti-fascist organizing to everything against ICE. I mean, there's a lot of, like, big and small projects, big and small. I mean that in a good way, you know. There's a lot of stuff going on from what we can see. So how does having a space tie into that? Like, you know, once this project gets going, like, how do you want to use that space to tie into everything else?
Something that I think could be very useful for starters is just having another space in a different, you know, part of town. Like, in Southeast is really where we're looking, Southeast Portland. Have, like, just another radical space for different groups to meet, you know, and just have their get-togethers and, like, do their organizational stuff. I'd like to see, you know, that space be accessible so that people can start their own groups and affinity groups and have meetings on projects that they want to start from, like, you know, from, like, an artist, like, using our real estate, you know, like our space as a place to have as a gathering hole. I'd also really like just to see, you know, this project of Inaris, which is this watering hole for, you know, anarchist punk bands and just anything that kind of intersects with that culturally, to have a place so that people can, you know, have their concerts and events and get their stuff going there. But like you say, it's really important to have bridges between groups and between movements, and have a space that, you know, different groups are using, but also, like, those groups are talking to each other. So something that's been spoken about, I guess, in affinity groups that I'm part of, is that it would be really meaningful to have a logistical network so that, for example, if things that are relevant for, you know, a protest or something need to be stored somewhere in like a strategic location, it would be really nice to have that available to people so that there's already, you know, like, you need tables to go tabling somewhere, you need megaphones, or you need water, or any of the logistical things that one might need to use in order to do an action, or even just, like, you know, do outreach as part of your affinity group or your project that you're doing. We want that to be available to people, and I would really like for us to make that available to people, not just a space for people to meet and use and intersect with each other in these casual and more serious contexts, but also to have the logistical things there ready for people to, you know, who are part of, you know, the not even necessarily directly part of Inaris, but that just are part of our general network to take advantage of and to do pop-up events or planned events or anything with that. But that those logistical concerns, I think it's been amazing to see what people have been able to do at Actions in Portland. I feel like I've learned a lot, honestly, from looking at people here and, you know, how they've been able to organize things. But I think that there's always room for more logistical capacity. Especially given, you know, if you're doing a protest, if things get, you know, confiscated, or if there's, you know, interruptions in your access to, you know, the supplies that you need to actually do the work, there should be backups, and there should be, like, contingency plans for that. So the logistics of it, I think, is very important, as well as just providing a cultural and, you know, political meeting space for people to be part of. Another thing that we wanted to do in the collective that's been talked about before by different people is getting together some sort of like reading group. I think that it would be great. One thing that was lacking in Inaris before we ended up temporarily closing up shop and moving out of the old location was we didn't have a central anchor activity, you know? And I think that it would be very suited for Inaris, just given the theme of the space and how it is this radical literature spot, to have a reading group of some kind. And possibly, if it's something that we can swing and get set up, a little recording space so that people can come and, you know, make use of that on a donation basis to, you know, record their albums or their spoken word or, you know, just make use of it. But if we had that spot for logistical reasons and everything else I said, I think it would be really beneficial, not just to the existing groups and organizations and formal sort of organizing that's already going on, but to affinity groups that are in Southeast, which is honestly kind of a hotbed of anarchism in the U.S., to make use of. And for that to solidify. Do either of you want to add anything?
Yeah, just that, you know, we have in Portland, we have like where we're at right now, like the Social Justice Action Center, and we have like the IWW Hall and stuff like that, but none of those places are actually open to the public. And then there's like this Cider Riot, which is like, you know, the Antifa bar, but that's a bar, you know, so it's not a, all ages have money to go there. So it just occurs to me that it would be really good to have like, well, kind of like you were saying, a front office for anarchy, but like, just like, yeah, like,
a place to get information, like someone who is just like, tell me about, you know, anarchism, or what can I read, you know, to inform me about like leftist ideas,
yeah,
and, you know, everything. A spot for both information and entertainment, basically.
Yeah, because people, I remember when I would work the open hours back when we had that spot up in St. John's, which is a neighborhood of Portland where the info shop used to be located. There would be people who would come from literally all over the world, just traveling, and they would say, "Oh, hey, I saw that you, like, this is your address in Slingshot. It's really cool that you have this." And there would be people who would come traveling through, there would be people from the neighborhoods. And I thought that was really positive just in of itself. Like, you can talk about, oh, we need like the material conditions for social change. We need these organizations. We need logistics. And I am very much of the opinion that that's very important. But it's also nice to just have a place that people can just walk into and be exposed to things that, you know, maybe you're just outside of their worldview or personal experience or social community. That to me is very exciting.
Yeah. Well, you brought up Cider Riot. You know, on May Day, obviously, Joey Gibson and his goons, you know, went there, and, there was an altercation. There's a lawsuit right now against Gibson.
Yeah, I heard about that. Yep. I was there. I didn't get afraid, but I was there.
So, you know, that happened also, you know, some of those same people, you know, in all probability were involved in vandalizing, the IWW Hall. I'm just curious, you know, like, as you prepare to open up a space, is that something that you're thinking about actively? Like, because I'm sure that these people will show up at some point in some capacity.
It's good to keep those, like, things in mind, and, you know, we definitely have, like, brought it up that these things have happened. There's, you know, the Joy Gibson, you know, et cetera, and They're always gonna come after us. It seems that, you know, we just gotta be safe. It's definitely not gonna hold us back to the point where it's like we're just scared and not gonna do anything. But there's definitely something to take note of, at least.
Yeah. One thing I would like to know, just because you brought up Cider Riot, is someone got clubbed with a baton at Cider Riot. I didn't really, like, I wasn't there, and I didn't really look into the details. But so what I heard is that someone got assaulted by one of the fascist people, fuckers, I don't know. and
people in scare quotes.
That same person, if I'm not mistaken, is the same person, Ian Kramer, who came into Inaris InfoShop during a private collective meeting where it's just people who are already in the collective. It was not a public meeting. It was not advertised or anything. And they walked in and started threatening us. And it took just basically like all like eight or whatever of us kind of telling them, like, hey, like, I don't really think that you want to do this right now. There's a lot more of us than more of you. And I think that you should just leave, and us kind of like de-escalating the situation. But I mean, it's definitely something that I've personally witnessed. I mean, these people definitely, they see these public spaces, and they see it as an invitation to come and try to, you know, perform their masculinity or whatever, which is really what it is, in my opinion. But at the end of the day, I mean, you know, like they said, it's ultimately, it's not going to hold us back. And, you know, if people come try to fuck with us, we have ways of dealing with that. You know, yeah, I guess that's all I'll say about that.
Well, yeah, that's a great response. I mean, like you said, they're going to come either way. So, you know, we should just be prepared and plan for that, because it's going to happen. And I mean, I think Gibson's going to walk away from that lawsuit in a worse place off than when he started. I mean, it's pretty clear from all the stuff. I mean, these watching Patriot Prayer people is a good for everybody, because it shows you literally like how to really just sink yourself into a hole on social media, just saying really silly stuff that legally is going to. Anyway,
like, I watched the videos they put up from Cider Riot, and I was like, I cannot believe that you put up these videos of, like, you guys showing up, being jackasses, getting your asses kicked, and leaving. Like, why would you, if there was a video of me doing that, I would be embarrassed as hell. Like, I would not put that on my social media.
Yeah. And not only that, but then they just, like, you know, they know that there's a lawsuit, and then they're just posting stuff like, yeah, it was me. Yep. It was me that had the weapon. And it was me that was like, blah, blah, blah. And it was me that did the felony. It's like, how dumb. I mean, it's a bunch of dumb people that are used to working with the police and getting away with everything. And I think obviously I don't have any hope in the police coming down on them, but I think in the situation of like a lawsuit brought against them where the evidence is so clear, I think they're going to hit a wall of reality that, you know, it's not going to go well for them. But, you know, then again, it could go the opposite way, and it wouldn't surprise me either. Just, you know, another question I wanted to ask is, you brought up having music and stuff. I think a lot of spaces, I remember, you know, 10 years ago, there was kind of a shift for a lot of info shops where people wanted to kind of move from being like, you know, we don't want to be an anarchy store 24/7. We want to be like more intentional and just basically be open when we have events. And I think actually it's really kind of cool that you all are talking about kind of a mix of everything, like kind of like being an open front and then having like events and then also having music. How does like having music filter into that? Is it is that a way that you can kind of fund the space? And also, how do you get around like permits and like noise and stuff like that?
So in Portland, I bottom lined and continue to bottom line a lot of shows for Inaris. We're doing benefit concerts. I can talk about that later. But as far as the legal situation for Portland music, if it's over before 10 p.m. In terms of like the amps and the, you know, loud drums and other things like that, it's technically like you could be considered to be exceeding the noise guidelines or limits or laws, but they don't enforce it until after 10 p.m. Like, you can call the hotline. The police are not going to show up, really. Basically, the rule is, like, if you have it over by 10, then that's, like, when quiet hours are throughout the city in terms of, like, the noise department. As far as permitting goes, we're not actually, like, selling tickets. Like, something I want to stress is that all of our events are open to anyone who abides by, like, just the guidelines of the space and, like, respects the space.
Yeah, all by donation.
Yeah, there's not, like, a cost barrier that we put. And that's really kind of fucked us over a lot of times in terms of making our rents, because we relied and continue, I'm sure will, in large part, rely on, you know, these donations that we get at shows and not, like, you know, we have a Patreon now. We're trying to figure that all out. But that's historically how we've figured out our rent and utilities and the other bills that need to get paid, basically, for the, you know, the, for the space to continue to be open. But, yeah, we haven't actually really had to. I mean, you know, when we want to book shows, we just make sure that we stay within those, you know, the hours that we're allowed to be playing music. And, yeah, that's pretty much how it's always worked, and we've never had a problem with that. Even when the neighbors were harassing us, which they did almost the entire time that that info shop was up in, you know, in St. John's for those, like, 3 or 4 years, the neighbors would harass us, and, you know, we would get building inspection things, but noise complaints never came up. And they were very much, I mean, the neighbors were not really, some of them were kind of jerks, and we're definitely not happy that there was this anarchist info shop that was like the safe refuge for, you know, like queer people and houseless people and all sorts of folks to sort of like be safe and like have like a place to hang out during the day and stuff. So that's actually something that we haven't had to deal with is noise complaints and permitting stuff for shows, which has been really fortunate because, you know, with how disorganized the project kind of was, you know, a year or two ago, certainly, that would have been impossible to navigate and would have been a huge barrier to us, but it just never came up.
And shows are always important because, I mean, that's part of what brought me in the first place is the shows.
Yeah.
And then I was like, okay, that brought my attention, you know, and then that gets the donations and then, you know, bands come along and it's always a good experience. That was a show, like they can vary in the, how many people have showed up, but
yeah.
They're like, it's always a good time, yeah.
And it's still really important to have all ages shows, like,
especially important.
Being
and
like
wheelchair
17
accessible.
And straight edge and not allowed to go to shows except a fucking bar, and I'm like, what is this bullshit, like.
Yeah, one thing that we do, like, also stress is that, you know, like, like in our new space or anything, it's going to be wheelchair accessible, and the other place, you know, was still in the bathroom. You can use the probably every wheelchair, but it was more that is another thing too, is so all ages, and then being able for wheelchair access and everything. And so for Inara is like being very inclusive of just like everyone to be able to attend, get as much people, you know, that want to go to be able to go and not have these barriers holding them back from attending.
So do you all have a space picked out right now, or you're still in the process of getting ready to acquire one?
Yeah, so we're doing pretty decently in the fundraising process, but there's still, like, I would say we still have about half of the fundraising to go. And so what we're doing now is we're organizing benefit shows just around town. I can't really speak to the locations that a couple of the shows are going to be, but one thing I can tell you for sure is that not this Saturday, not tomorrow, but next Saturday on May 25th, there will be a show sort of towards the closing hours of Cider Riot, at Cider Riot, that's going to be a benefit for Inaris. And we're also, you can check our Facebook page, facebook.com/InarisInfoShop/events. We'll have more details about shows for the days of the 31st of May, July 30th and August 20th. And if people want to hit us up to help set us, you know, up for some summer concerts, that would be really sick. If you are in a band and you are in the Northwest or you're going to be touring out here this summer, definitely contact us.
Cool. Well, anything else that you all want to talk about or say? Do you have a date in mind or a general idea when you think that a space might open?
I'm aiming for the end of the summer after these shows are done. Perhaps even before. It just really depends how successful we are in terms of like getting the money together, but we're trying to do this as soon as possible because, you know, I mean,
it's been a while.
it's been a while. And also like things are, I don't know. I don't really know what's going to happen next year, honestly. Like, I'm just saying, like, we're in a politically kind of strange moment, and we need anarchism now. It's just, absolutely. It's required. I'm sorry.
Feminism, the modern day F word, rejected and thrown aside. But who the fuck is doing their fighting? This tomb is given by our mothers and our sisters. Have the gift to wish your name.
Okay, once again, we are back for another week. You know, just one really horrible factoid to begin with. There's an article in The Intercept that came out today. 17 states have introduced laws to create new penalties for pipeline protesters. I mean, I think if you want to kind of peel the veil back about what this system is all about, I mean, there it is. I mean, literally, remember that guy in the Coast Guard that was found with a stockpile of weapons, and he had like a white nationalist manifesto. He's going to kill politicians and like famous people. You know, they said, nope, we're not going to charge him with terrorism. But literally, there's 17 states that have introduced laws to, in some cases, declare it terrorism or something akin to even protesting against pipeline infrastructure.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, what's fascinating to me and very telling about this is that it's specifically about pipelines, right? So in the past, we've had protest laws, right, in the United States, and sometimes they haven't survived court challenge, and sometimes they have. But they're general protest laws, generally, right? Like, no one can wear a mask at a protest, right? Like, that's a law in Virginia, for example, right? Like, you just can't wear a mask. Oh, it's during home demonstrations in Virginia, right? You can't wear a mask at a home demonstration, right? Like, different states have different laws like this. What's really unique about this, though, is that it's very specifically and declaredly targeting pipeline protesters. And those laws only apply to that. There's a lot of squishy legal room in that. And this is one of the things outside of the fact that it's like the state curtailing the ability of people to organize. One of the things that's really concerning here is that the penalties are very steep in a lot of these cases. And what defines a pipeline protest is very vague. And so technically, they could almost apply this to anybody if they wanted to. Like, if someone's out there for an ecological cause, they can apply this to them.
Or filming.
Or Yeah. I mean, we'll see if these things survive court challenge. Because they're so specific, they might violate the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. We'll see.
I just think, I mean, I think one thing we should keep in mind is that, I mean, we've all, you know, and it's going down, of course, is, you know, guilty of this is probably more than anybody, but like, you know, talking about anti-fascism as this boogeyman, you know, this cultural war reference point. I mean, famously there was that unmask Antifa bill. From my understanding, I looked it up the other day, it hasn't gone anywhere really. But I mean, like, literally these laws, some of these laws against pipeline protesters, I mean, went through really fast.
Yes, they did.
And, I mean, they went through with, you know, at least tactic support from Democrats as well.
Yeah. Well, and in some states, they're passing laws that aren't specifically anti-pipeline laws, like anti-pipeline protest laws. Right. But they're aiming at the same things. Like in Ohio, for example, there's a law that says that if you trespass on a resource extraction site, that all of a sudden is a felony trespass, not a misdemeanor trespass, just because it's a resource extraction site. Now, what counts as a resource extraction site? That's a really good question. And there hasn't been a test case yet to really determine that. But so you've got things like this in Ohio, and there's other states that pass laws like this too. Right now is a really fraught time legally. Not just for anti-pipeline protest laws and anti-protest laws, but in a lot of ways, it's a very fraught time legally. And I really encourage people to, you know, research what's going on where you live, know what your legal limits are, talk to a sympathetic lawyer if you need to, not because you're necessarily under threat, but just for clarification, because it's always important to know when you're going into an action what risk you're taking on. And whether or not you care to abide by laws, right, which I don't particularly care about, you still need to know what the consequences are if you get caught not abiding by the laws, right? And so really pay careful attention, because the last thing any of us need is someone to get wrapped up for 8 to 10 years for a minor legal violation just because they violated some very specific law they didn't, right?
Yeah, there's also, you know, speaking of these, you know, shitty laws, you know, just today it was announced, you know, tragically, that the sixth child has died in the last several months in Border Patrol custody. This is since December, so there's now been six children that have died in the care of Border Patrol, either being picked up and taken to a detention facility, or at a detention facility, or at a detention facility and then taken to some sort of hospital after they've gotten sick. And
yeah.
This is also happening against another backdrop of Ben Carson, who was chosen by Trump to lead, you know, public housing, and which is just hilarious because he has, you know, he's a former brain surgeon, has no connection to public housing whatsoever, but was chosen
for a housing project though. Near a housing project. He grew up near a housing project. That is literally Trump's declared reason why he appointed Ben Carson.
Right.
Said he's near a housing project, but not in one.
And also he's very conservative and he's African American, so, you know, they put him in there as, you know, like, oh, look, we've got a black person, you know, in charge of public housing. Like, we know what we're doing. But anyway, so in March, the Trump administration announced that they had, you know, a new budget, and they wanted to make more drastic cuts to public housing. It would be, I believe, 16% from what it was before, and they've been making cuts since 2017. And then this month, Carson and Trump have been, you know, rattling their sabers, saying that they're going to deport up to 100,000 people that are undocumented that are living in public housing. This includes about 55,000 children. So basically, if you're living in public housing and anybody in your family is undocumented, therefore they're saying that they're going to basically, you know, they're going to totally evict your whole family.
Yes.
And at the same time, Ben Carson's going on Tucker Carlson show and like Fox News shows and everything like that, saying the immigrants are taking up too much of our public housing. We need public housing for, quote, our people, because they care so much about, you know, the poor people in the United States. They need more housing for, quote, our people. And they're trying to use this kind of division as to say, like, oh, you know, you should support, you know, this mouse roundup and kicking out of people from public housing if and when that starts to happen. It's interesting. You know, at the same time, like, they also recently announced that they're going to stop trans people from having equal access to homeless shelters. This is through HUD as well. And we were just saying before the program started that it seems like they're really trying to force this sort of, you know, intersectionality between all these things that are happening, whether it's denying trans people access, you know, slashing public housing, saying they're going to kick out massive amounts of undocumented people in public housing. Of course, all the abortion bans they're trying to ram through. I mean, there's all this stuff that's going on, and people are starting to get out in the streets again.
Yes, they are. And in a lot of cities, especially in states with new abortion laws, there were pretty massive protests, like just yesterday, all across the country. against those abortion laws. And you're starting to see this kind of fusion between people that are going to those demonstrations and people that show up at pride parades and people that show up at anti-police brutality demonstrations and people that are showing up at immigration stuff, which is a good thing that there's starting to be this kind of discussion that crosses single issues, because we all know that at the end of the day, dealing with a single, what we define as an issue, right, is an approach which entirely exists on the level of policy and discourse with the state, right? Talking to the state and asking them not to be as horrible as they are. When in reality, when we start to cross those lines and we can start to see the picture in more of a total full way, like more of a robust way, what that tends to facilitate is it tends to facilitate more systemic approaches, right? That we can start to see that, well, this isn't just an issue of immigrants and discrimination against trans folks and the precarity of people in public housing and things like this. This is actually a question of institutionalized discrimination from the level of the state. And that's really a question of sovereignty, right? The precarity of the lower class in the United States is really a capitalism question, just as is migration and, you know, human migration at this point in human history is a capitalism question and a question of statecraft, right? We need to start drawing these connections more. I know a lot of people do some writing on things like Facebook and they have their own blogs and stuff. Like, these are the kinds of connections we need to start talking about, right? We need to pull people out of their reactionary single issue approaches to things and start to draw these lines a little bit more. Luckily, we're in a point during this journey through the Trump administration that it seems to be that people are starting to do that on their own, right? But we can definitely play a role in helping to reinforce that right now. And this is a pretty opportune time because things are accelerating.
You know, it's you know, we were also talking about this too, but I mean, like, so when Ben Carson gets on Tucker Carlson and basically is like making this appeal to like the poor black, you know, proletariat, saying like, hey, you know, it's the immigrants you've got to worry about. I mean, like, who is he talking to? Like, who is he trying to convince? Or, you know, who is convinced by that? I don't know, it just seems like a law of diminishing returns.
It is, and you can see that in the polling, right? So polling came out. I forgot who did the big poll that got a ton of coverage this week. But polling came out showing that something like 54% of Americans would never think about voting for Donald Trump. It does not matter who he's running against. And that's a really telling number, especially because that same poll put his approval rating at 37%. Mm-hmm. If you're in the Trump camp, if you're in the Trump administration or part of the 2020 campaign at this point, you've got to be sweating bullets because those aren't good numbers. And they have to remind themselves, I would imagine, consistently internally that they won three states by like under 100,000 votes each.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean,
those are not huge margins.
No.
That's what pushed them over the edge. And those are states that traditionally go Democrat. So like,
yeah.
And that he's pulling way behind generic Democratic candidate X in at this point.
It's funny that the DNC guy, the one that Trump calls Alfred E. Newman, I guess one of his
Buttigieg, yeah.
Yeah, one of his things is like getting rid of the Electoral College.
Yes.
And it's just funny. I mean, to watch like people on Fox News like defend the Electoral College as this like, you know, liberatory,
yes,
you know, It's so funny. I mean, these people literally have no ideology other than like what keeps them in power is good.
Yeah.
I mean, hasn't Trump attacked like the idea of the Electoral College before?
Yes, he absolutely did. And so this has become it's like politics, or I wouldn't call it politics, statecraft in the United States has become a team sport, essentially, right? That people are choosing a side at this point based on how they feel about Donald Trump. And are willing to pull intellectual somersaults to justify that sometimes, right? Again, and I always encourage people to listen to the show to do this, but talk to a liberal, right? And you'll see this happen. Like, talk to liberals about economics, right? And listen to them bring up all the problems of capitalism and then be like, cool, so maybe abolishing capitalism is a great thing. And they'll be like, well, you know, but business and blah, 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 blah. Seriously, though, like, it is absolutely crucial for us to understand what kind of intellectual gymnastics are going on right now, because they are being honed to a fine art at this point. And neither the Democrats nor the Republicans are able to make a coherent argument about essentially anything right now. which, again, that's a really good opening for us as, like, anarchists in the United States who tend to be very smart, intelligent, articulate people who are capable of writing and making our points very clearly to do so, right? This is not a time for people writing, like, 200-word screeds full of rhetoric that's only going to appeal to us. Like, this is a time to start having these conversations, because one of the things that's been a result of our activities over the last 6 or 7 years is that we're now actually legitimate interlocutors in the political discourse, right? And our positions are not being hidden away in dark alleys of the political underground anymore, right? We're a real force to be contended with, and we need to be articulating that.
Yeah. And, you know, we've said this a million times before, but, you know, I hear this in the mainstream media all the time. Like, the only thing Trump has to run on is the economy. I mean, again, the economy booming does not mean that things are good for us. You know, the fact that GDP is through the roof, that corporations and, you know, the so-called 1% are making a shit ton of money. Why is that? It's because the rest of us are getting screwed. I mean, I've said this again and again, but since the recession, the economy has restructured itself into austerity model in which we work longer and are paid less, and therefore they're making more profits. The problem with that is, though, is that eventually you come to a point in which, you know, the wheels have fallen off the car, and that, you know, just like now with, I'm sure people are noticing it if you've been to the grocery store this week, you've probably seen a spike in, like, just basic food commodities because gas has gone up, I think, like, by a dollar.
Something
and, you
like know, that.
You see that kind of ripple effect where you're like, holy fuck, the mustard costs like $6. Like, what the hell happened? You know, we're definitely seeing that. And again, with things like automation and machine learning coming more and more, I believe even this week I heard on the radio that the post office, which has faced massive cuts over the past couple of years, they're now actually looking to integrate autonomous vehicles into you know, their workforce. So basically getting rid of people that drive the work trucks,
right,
and just have them go around or something like that, you know, more cuts to unionized, you know, decent jobs. And,
well, in a more immediate sense, what all those analysts are getting wrong, is that they're relying on traditional presidential political dynamics to make that claim. Right. That right. Traditionally presidents have run on the economy. The economy is good. You have a much better chance of getting reelected. The classic example of that is George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton, where the economy sucked when George H.W. Bush ran for reelection. He lost, and the economy was great when Clinton ran for reelection and he won, even though people had all kinds of problems with his sort of like personal life or whatever. What's unique about the Trump administration, besides everything, is that at this point, his approval rating on the economy is relatively high. It's over 45%.
Yes.
But it's way higher than his actual approval rating, which is very telling. And what that tells me is that for as much as Trump wants to try and run on the economy, the fact that the economy is superficially on a statistical level on paper looking like it's doing better, that's not enough for a lot of people to overcome the fact that he's just kind of a douchebag.
Well, the thing that everybody says is that unemployment is low. But the point is not that people don't have a job. The point is that the economy is structured to the point where you have to have 3 jobs and then drive for Lyft and then sell weed out of the back of your house and then rent one of your rooms out to, you know, on Airbnb and so on and so on and so forth, and trying to hobble together, you know, some sort of life that's always precarious, that you never know if you're going to like have enough, and that the cost of living, the cost of transportation, rent is completely going through the roof, and that you're just on this constant treadmill, which by in its own making creates massive, massive, massive amounts of wealth for a small amount of people.
Yes.
Which is driving this whole illusion that the quote, the economy is doing well, which it is. But again, that brings up the reality that just because it is doing well, that doesn't mean that we are. But I mean, that is for the ability, you know, we need to basically look towards a future in which we're going to make the economy stop
and that capitalism is not going to exist, because if we don't, then we're going to burn up the earth and we're not going to live here anymore. So I think it is important to make that psychological connection between, you know, the economy doing well doesn't mean good for us, and if the economy is doing poorly, then maybe something's going right.
Well, and that raises the second question, which is, what is Trump really running on? Because it's not the economy, right? Like, all these analysts are wrong. And what's really clear, and you can see this in what we were just discussing with HUD policy, and attacks on immigrants, and attacks on trans people, and attacks on women, that really what Trump is running on is white male identitarianism, essentially. He's taken on every single position of the conservative movement, right? And you can see him one by one, like, as those conservative movement is has an incredibly short attention span and is very into novelty. And so the outrage of the moment is constantly changing, and Trump takes on all of them. And that's what he's running on. I think where he runs into significant problems here is that the conservative movement is not as big as it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 30 years ago. It's much smaller now and is aging out. Right, people are literally dying off. Like, the amount of evangelicals in the United States is dropping because kids are raised in these born again Christian households and choose not to follow that same path when they get to adulthood, because it's restrictive and conservative and messed up. And so now that you're
that, but I've talked to a lot of people that work at churches and stuff, and it's hard for them to get people to come to church.
Sure.
When everybody's working all the time, and I mean, there's no such thing as weekends anymore.
Yes.
Your weekend is a Tuesday and Wednesday.
Yes.
You know, that sometimes you don't get called in. I mean, that's your weekend. So this idea that people are going to go to church, I mean, you know, be like saying you're guaranteed a vacation. I mean, it's just not going to happen. So I think it's funny when conservatives say, you know, millennials are killing, you know, Christianity, or no one wants to be a police officer anymore. It's like, well, yeah, because that shit sucks and no one wants to do it. But also the fact that, like, you've created this economy in which we're all serfs to, like, apps and shit. And, like, what do you expect? I mean, no wonder everybody wants to get drunk and fuck each other on Tinder, because that's all there is to do.
Well, I think that there's one big thing, and I know we've talked about this a bunch on this podcast, but there's no way to underestimate the impact of this. The reality is that the conservative movement in the past was built on this idea of generational morality, right? So you have morality, you teach it to your children, they teach it to their children, they teach it to their children, right? You never leave your small-ass town in whatever state you live in. And the conservative movement was grounded in those kind of communities, right? It's kind of very static, very restrictive, very repressive, very traditional communities.
Pleasantville. Right?
Yeah, well, or things that aspire to be Pleasantville, that, like, saw Pleasantville as their ideal, right? When in reality, they were, like, a crappy failing farming town in the central of Illinois, like, central Illinois or something, right? But now that we're fully enmeshed in the adulthood of the first generation that came up with the internet, as, like, a thing that we could use all the time to look up information, it's really hard to hold restrictive structures that are grounded in information limitation together, right? And so one of the things that you used to hear in the 90s is that evangelical pastors would tell people, don't read books. Books are bad. The only books you should read are Christian books, right? And pastors still say that. The problem is, for them, is that you can't enforce that anymore, right? All someone needs is a smartphone, and now they're completely out of that universe. And so sometimes it leads to really atrocious outcomes, right? Like the alt-right, where the thing that they've decided is bad is multiculturalism. That was what they decided was the morality that they needed to break, was multiculturalism. And so they fell into, like, racist, you know, social circles, right? On Reddit and on the internet, gamer circles and things like that. But for a lot of other people, the internet has been this, like, source of an outside world for a lot of people, that they can now see outside of their small town. They can see outside of the morality that their parents are pushing on them. They can see outside of what their pastors are trying to impose on the community, and they can start to make decisions on their own. And what that's done is it's actually made the places where the conservative movement is traditionally strong, like the South and in rural America, way less politically homogenous than they used to be. And that the people who still hold on to that political homogeneity are in their 50s and 60s and 70s, and they're aging out, like they're literally dying off. And there's innumerable metrics that you can look at to demonstrate this sociologically. But it's definitely a phenomenon that's happening. And so as the Trump campaign does this thing where what they're trying to do is reinforce their base, try and draw on as many people to that base as they can.
They make it smaller.
Yes, they make it smaller. Absolutely. And because, especially because they do it in such an abrupt and offensive way. They make the base smaller. And that is a losing strategy. Like, it was okay in 2016, but every year that goes by, that's a less and less successful strategy.
Yeah, were they barely squeaked in 2016 anyway?
Right. So they can, I mean, George W. Bush had September 11th to run on, right? And he leveraged that as much as he possibly could. What Trump is trying to do is run a campaign more along the lines of what Reagan did, where he tried to unite all the different factions of conservatism and rural America and white America together into an electoral coalition. And that was enough to get Reagan elected twice. The thing is, that coalition is a fraction of the size that it was before.
Yeah, and ironically, I mean, and now the rallying cry, of course, is, you know, against quote-unquote socialism, and, you know, we talked about in the last episode. But the thing is that what's really fueling, you know, this, you know, socialist upheaval, or, you know, sort of, you know, I would just call it a shift to the left, really, is Donald Trump himself. I mean, the longer Trump's in there, the more people are going to go to the left, you know?
Yeah, well, and what is Donald Trump? I mean, like, and we talked about this a little bit. We were talking about Trump's background a few episodes ago, but what is Donald Trump? He's some
Democrat.
Well, outside of that, I mean, he somehow sold himself as a man of the people, but Donald Trump named his most recent child Barron. Right? I mean, this is a guy who...
That kid always looks like he just, like, engulfed, like, a whole thing of helium. Like, he looks so out of it and just, like, lost. He's like, where the fuck am I? Who stole me? Where's my real parents?
He looks like, confused and, like, he doesn't want to be wherever he is.
No, like, if you watch... Like, you've seen the, when he gets inducted and he has his little hand up and he's like, oh, I thought... And, like, his kid's there and his kid's like...
I feel so bad for that kid. Like...
Yeah.
Life has got to be super messed up. Like, I feel.
Oh, man. Well, look who your parents are. You've got Donald Trump and then Melania or whatever the hell her name is. Just some weirdo.
He gets hassled about it all the time. Like, I feel horrible for that kid. And, like, don't want to pile on to a small child, but he did name his kid Barron, right? I mean, guy is the epitome of someone aspiring to be a patrician, East Coast, upper class, wealthy person. That's literally what he's trying to do. He has spent his entire life crafting an image of himself as if he's part of that patrician social circle on the East Coast, when he's very much not. But he definitely presents himself as such until 2016, when all of a sudden he was a man of the people.
Right.
Right. But if anyone really needs to gain a grasp of what's going on, it's not hard to find documentaries about Donald Trump's life. People should watch them because... what he's been presenting is he's a man of all the people, specifically working people. What he's actually doing is he's putting forward kind of traditional conservative positions, which are all about privatization, austerity, the cutting of public services, the elimination of the New Deal, so on, so on, so on. Right.
Yeah. Just like, I mean, I was just talking to somebody about this the other day, but I mean, like, you know, one that's always hit me is, you know, one of these images where Trump signed something in relation to coal. And they have some, like, coal miners in the background, and they're, like, they have their coal hats on, and they're smiling. And it's, like, you know, a lot of the stuff that he put through in terms of coal that supposedly is going to bring coal back was, like, slashing back regulations, slashing especially things, like, in regards to, like, health and safety. And, you know, even in the reports that the Trump administration itself wrote about the effects of what was going to happen was it literally said that, like, more people will die because we're taking back these – health and safety regulations that were in place.
Yes.
And I mean, it's so bizarre. And I think this has to do with a lot of the way that people see themselves. And I saw this in like the so-called like Black Smoke Matters, trucker movement where they tried to, you know, they were going to do like a massive strike and they were going to like, you know, strike on the freeway. And there was like a real conservative element within that that saw itself as, quote, like against regulation, stuff like that, which, you know, again, like we're not saying like government regulation is like the shit or like the end all. But I mean, instead of seeing those basic rules in place because of workers struggling or people saying like, look, like this is, you know, the safety minimum, this is the health minimum, instead seeing themselves as like their own boss, as independent contractors, is kind of like buying into that. Well, and thinking that like they were on par with like the big capitalist corporations that were really running the show. And in reality, they're not. And that's why they continue to get screwed. And that's why they're continuously in a position where they're trying to fight, you know, for a living wage, for access to work, you know, mm-hmm. as they're slowly getting automated out of the picture.
Well, and if we really look at the question of deregulation, right, what's being proposed is not actually deregulation, right? It's not limiting government control in any sort of way. It's just shifting the focus of that.
Right.
Right. So when you look at deregulation over something like, say, power grids, right, it's not that the government is saying do whatever you want with power grids. What it's saying is we're going to protect the property of these companies that are now logistically responsible for running the power grid. That what it is the state saying we're going to protect the ability of capital to function as capital, not as regulated capital. And that's it. That is in no way a difference in kind from what we have now, right? It's not in any way a reduction of the scale of state sovereignty. All it is the state choosing a side, right? Every time we hear deregulation, what we should hear is pro-capitalism, right? The state is going to use police force to impose capitalism more. And they're going to do that by selling off things that ultimately we paid for to the highest bidder, right? Which often isn't a very high bid. Just as an example of that, and this didn't happen in the U.S., but in Mexico, when the U.S. government bailed out Mexico in the 90s, which the U.S. government loaned the Mexican government, I think it was like $32 billion under Bill Clinton, something like that. What came along with that loan was a promise to deregulate land holdings and telecommunications infrastructure. And so some mid-level investment banker named Carlos Slim gets together a bunch of investors and buys the entire telecommunications infrastructure in Mexico for like 1/10,000th of what it was actually worth. And Carlos Slim is now like the third richest man on earth, right? What really happened there is that the U.S. government said, cool, we'll give you this money, but you need to help kick back some of that wealth to us, right? We want to get billionaires out of this, essentially. There's a lot of stories about this with Argentina as well. If anyone wants to research the Argentinian financial crisis, you can really see what deregulation actually means and why that's sort of a misnomer, just by looking at what happened in Argentina in the early 2000s. So I really do encourage people to do that. Naomi Klein wrote a lot of really great stuff about that. She did a documentary about Argentina, which I'm blanking on the name of off the top of my head at the moment. But
it's called The Take. So, you know, Take. I think Naomi Klein is a you know, very limited. I mean, lefty, like, I don't even know if considers herself anti-capitalist or like a socialist even, but I mean, the film itself is about factory workers at a factory that has become abandoned because of the financial crisis. I mean, literally people like elites in Argentina just like literally got their money out of banks and like fled the country.
And then literally for cars. Like they
drove like in the middle of the night, they're just like, we're getting the fuck out of here. Just
like there's footage of a line of armored cars stretching from the middle of Buenos Aires all the way to the airport, which is like 10 miles away. Yes. And all those cars are full of money and gold.
Right. And then like right after that, there was the, you know, the street. This is in 2001, by the way. But I mean, Argentina, like in that period is fascinating. I mean, so the financial crisis hit. There was a series of street riots that toppled a succession of governments. Mm-hmm. There were creation of neighborhood assemblies, which people formed, you know, basically on the basis of neighborhoods. There was really interesting stuff, like a lot of the assemblies were like kicking out like a lot of like lefty or Marxist people that were trying to basically use them to push a certain party. So that, I mean, they were very anarchistic without mm-hmm. being anarchist in a sense. Then you started to have these factory occupations, and one of them is detailed in the take, but, you know, these workers take over their factory after their bosses have left, and mm-hmm. they basically end up fighting the state and, you know, running things as a collective, and there's other factories that have done the same, and they've kind of formed this network. And a lot of those still exist. I think one of the most famous one is, it starts with a T or something like that. They make, like, textiles, I believe.
Oh, yeah, the one that makes tiles. I forget the name of the factory.
Tiles. Yeah. Yeah, but, I mean, there's, you know, I mean, it's, obviously Argentina is, you know, not like an anarchist communal society at this point, but I mean, there are still these lingering things that have come out of the revolts of 2001 that are still there, like the factory occupations, and there are still networks of occupied factories that still exist, and a lot of them do still like face eviction, and they still fight the police. In fact, like the tile one, I think their logo is like a slingshot, because workers there carry slingshots with them. If the riot police show up, then they fight the police to hold on to the factory. But I mean, you know, lots of kind of experiments, a lot of along the lines of, you know, what we saw in, you know, anarchist Barcelona and other places where a lot of factories and the means of production were taken over, you know, wages being equalized, skills and jobs being shared and stuff like that, and rotation of certain managerial tasks and everything like that. Basically,
it was very organic, right? It's not like, it wasn't like Spain in the sense that there wasn't a huge anarchist trade union organized.
That's true, yeah.
It was very organic and spontaneous. There's a book, AK Press put it out. I think it was called Horizontalism is the name of the book.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't read it in years, but it's a really good rundown of what happened in Argentina, and I really encourage people to read that, especially if you're newer to things, because what happened in Argentina was very influential on a lot of people in my generation.
I see millions of people just coming up with anarchism without ever having – we're not going to have any bosses, we're going to do things.
In a lot of ways, what happened in Argentina was just as influential on people in my age group, especially where I'm from, as the EZLN was, or as what happened in Greece later.
Yeah, there's,
well, I mean, there's some anarchist revolt, right? And that was really interesting. So I really encourage people to read up on that, because it was a very unique scenario. Also, if you want to read up on deregulation, and I've hyped this book before, people should really read it, A Brief History of Neoliberalism by David Harvey is the best primer on economic globalization that you could possibly get. And it's only like 150 pages long. So and it's good to read. David Harvey's a good writer. So really encourage people to pick up copies of both of those, or find them on the internet or whatever. Again, especially if you're newer to things, to help you kind of gain some of the context, some of the stuff that happened in the past, and some of the discussions that happened around that. I think it's really useful.
Yeah. A couple more plugs. I mean, if you have Netflix, I would actually encourage you to watch the, Chomsky documentary, Death of the American Dream.
Yes.
Which is like, I mean, super basic. It's like they literally have all the words at the bottom. You know, it's like Chomsky talking very slowly. So, like, have a coffee with you so you can stay awake the whole time. But, I mean, he does a really good job, I think, actually, in that film of linking neoliberalism with the burst of, you know, liberation movements in the 60s and 70s in the U.S. And basically, like, all of these struggles, these anti-capital struggles that are coming out, whether it's like the student movement, the Black Panthers, anti-war, blah, blah, blah. I mean, they are all articulating a need to, like, destroy capitalism. Like, we have to do a better job of, like, fundamentally defending our interests and making sure that capitalism is here to stay in the United States. You know, essentially defending the class interest of the ruling class. And, you know, lo and behold, by the 70s, you have a new regime in place of neoliberalism that's quite different than the post-war kind of like, here, let me give you access to, you know, cheap home loans. Like, let me, you know, we'll create something called the middle class that, you know, will give you more of a buffer. You know, your kids can go to college pretty much for free. We're going to regulate the economy in a certain way, so on and so forth. I mean, that was over by the 70s.
And a lot of people don't think about Richard Nixon in relation to that, right? But a lot of these policies really started under the Nixon administration. They started with the floating of the U.S. dollar, right, taking dollar off the gold standard. And what that allowed to happen was it allowed the amount of currency in circulation, right, the theoretical currency, to expand really dramatically because it was no longer tied to a physical commodity, right? So, I mean, tying a currency to a gold standard doesn't actually change the calculation around abstract value that much. What it does change is it changes the calculation over the amount of abstract value contained in that currency. So like it's no longer tied to an amount of gold, but now it's tied to supply and demand, right? So how much trade are you doing? How much demand is there for the US dollar? How much money is leaving the United States and being exchanged into other currencies, right? That all happened under Nixon. And without that happening, none of the rest of what happened with credit deregulation and the building of the credit card industry and the growth of the mortgage industry would have been possible. What's absolutely crucial about that is that without those things, the America that we live in today would look very, very different. That it was actually the credit card industry and the expansion of debt, the growth of financialization, right? So investments in the stock market and in sort of stock market tied securities and things like that, and the growth of consumer lending and houses and cars and things that allowed the United States economy to continue to function, even though unemployment was going up, wages were going down at the same time, and cost of living was increasing, right? If it wasn't for essentially the fact that we created money out of nothing through fractional reserve banking, the U.S. economy would have collapsed decades ago.
Yeah.
And actually what we've been doing is we've been kind of creating this sort of balancing act where we're trying to keep the amount of liquid capital that people have access to high enough to be able to compensate for the amount of debt that exists to compensate for the lack of liquid capital that people have access to. And in 2008 and 9, that calculus got thrown off and the entire economy crashed. But this is one of those other moments, I think, that's really critical for anarchists specifically to understand. And the reason it's important for us to understand those kind of dynamics is that we tend to think of specifically the U.S. state as this giant behemoth that is almost invincible, right? Unless they're trying to fight a war overseas, which in our lifetime they have not been very successful at winning those. But we still tend to think of them as of the state in the United States as relatively invincible on a domestic level. But the reality of the situation is that everything that exists right now is incredibly precarious. And little tiny interruptions or changes in those dynamics can cause catastrophic outcomes, right? And disrupt the entire ability of capitalism to function. And those are moments that we need to be paying attention to, right?
Yeah.
And I'll get back to something that Foucault talks about, right? And yeah, citing Foucault on a podcast, sure. But I'm going to go back to something that Foucault talks about where someone asked him what his project was, like his theoretical project. And he said something along the lines of, and this is paraphrase, obviously. But he said something along the lines of, my project is to do theory about the edges of crisis. Because at the edges of crisis, we can really see the real dynamics of what's going on. And that's also what I'm encouraging a lot of us to do. Look at the dynamics that cause the crises that we've been living through our entire lives, right? Because
yeah.
One thing that's typified the life of the millennial generation, it's been that we've lived in constant crisis the entire time we've been alive.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to understand why so we can understand where the weak points in state logistics are and we can understand when the opportune moments to act are. So again, learn your economics, go back and understand the history of globalization and deregulation, start to grasp how that's impacted things like migration crises, ecological crisis, economic crisis, so on, because it'll give us a much more thorough understanding of the tactical conditions that we find ourselves in every day.
Yeah, and speaking to that point, I remembered the two statements that I was referencing. There's actually a really good article, and it's going down from IGD called Bloodstains, Neoliberalism, Conspiracy, and Civility. And it basically talks about the history of neoliberalism and how that ties into how we got to Trumpism today. But I'm just going to read a little bit from it. By the early 1970s, things were literally exploding across the U.S. as liberation movements and struggles popped up in poor neighborhoods, outside army bases, at college campuses, and everywhere from communes to armed struggle groups were formed. In the summer of 1971, would-be Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell argued in the so-called Powell Memorandum, which was sent to the Chamber of Commerce,
major business lobby that argued that business interests were in fact, quote, losing control over the United States. And it goes on to say that basically all these self-interest groups are entering the political arena, meaning that somehow the poor, the working class, black people, women, queer folks, I mean, they're entering into politics and somehow being able to express their grievances, and that's a major problem.
And oh, yeah.
Basically, society needs to, you know, the rich basically better do something about it or else the shit's going to hit the fan. So 4 years later, there's another really interesting, and I encourage people to look these up and read them. I mean, they're fascinating because they're essentially discussion documents from a ruling class, you know, elite perspective that says, like, look, like, what's happening, guys? Like, shit's getting crazy. Like, what's going to happen? Are they going to bring out the guillotine? 4 years later, Trilateral Commission made a similar assessment, as Noam Chomsky noted in the film Requiem for American Dream, which we referenced earlier. This is what Chomsky said, which I think is great. He says, over on the liberal side, there's something exactly similar. The first major report of the Trilateral Commission, a non-government group founded by David Rockefeller in July 1973, is concerned with this. It's called the Crisis of Democracy. Their flavor is indicated by the fact that they pretty much staffed the Carter administration. They were also appalled by the democratizing tendencies of the 1960s and thought that we have to react to it. They were concerned that there was an excess of democracy developing. Previously passive and obedient parts of the population that were sometimes called the special interests were beginning to organize and try to enter the political arena. And they said, that imposes too much pressure on the state. It can't deal with all these pressures. So therefore, they have to return to passivity and become depoliticized. They were particularly concerned with what was happening to young people. The young people are getting too free and independent, they said.
Yeah. Well, and we're watching a somewhat similar thing happen today. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
It's easy to look back at the 1960s and think of it as the sort of heyday of political organizing. But in reality, a lot of the people that were organizing back then, and this is, again, excluding the civil rights movement where there were like very experienced organizers, but a lot of the student organizers in the 1960s were totally new to this and actually weren't involved for that long. Right. Most of them were involved for 4 or 5 years and then dropped out. And went back to their lives and became like new agey hippies or self-help people or whatever, right? And a lot of them ended up voting for Reagan, which, you know, kickstarted the dynamics that we live in today wonderfully. But what we really need to look at, and this is a thing that friends of mine have written essays about and things, and I think that it's a really salient point, the things that are going on today in a lot of ways are just as historic. Right. What we're watching happen right now is we're watching a number of marginalized communities start to stand up and go, we're not going to be relegated to silence anymore. Right. And that the reforms that happened in the past weren't good enough. That really we need autonomy. We need the ability to control our own destiny. We need the ability to be able to make our own decisions. Right. There has not been an upswing like that in that kind of discourse since the 1960s. And in the 1960s, almost everything changed, right? It got very close to a scenario of, you know, global collapse of capitalism. Right now, we're looking at a somewhat similar thing, even though the features of that are very different. And the political initiatives are much more diffuse and much more localized than they were back then. And they're being organized in completely different ways than they used to be. But at the same time, the frequency of action and the intensity of action really isn't entirely all that different. And in a lot of ways, the intensity of action has actually increased. There was a study done about the amount of sort of direct action, confrontational demonstrations that have happened in the Western world. And one of the things that that study was demonstrating is that there's actually more of a concentration of that now than there was in 1968. So we should all think about that because we are in a period of intense grassroots political conflict right now, even though it doesn't often feel that way.
Yeah. Well, before we dive too much into this rabbit hole, let's touch on just, you know, speaking of Trump, you know, what the hell has gone on this week?
Yeah.
We have meetings where Trump is storming out and then like having press conferences with weird signs that no one really understands what's going on with. I mean, what is going on? And of course, you know, is all this talk of impeachment, is that just a bunch of hot air, or what's actually happening?
So, good question. There's a lot of thoughts about that. If I were to answer that question, what I would say is I think what's happening right now, and just for some background, what's been going on for those of you that haven't been like super paying super close attention, what's been happening is that House Democrats have been subpoenaing all kinds of people. Don McGahn, the former White House counsel. They subpoenaed Hope Hicks. They subpoenaed Donald Trump Jr. They subpoenaed Robert Mueller, right? Bob Barr, all kinds of people have been getting these subpoenas. And one by one, the Trump administration has been ordering them to refuse to show up and testify. Meaning that all of these people are technically in contempt of Congress, even if a resolution isn't passed because they refuse to comply with a subpoena. You can't just not show up to Congress if you get subpoenaed. Like, there's laws about that and stuff. But so a lot of people have just refused to show up in the last week for congressional testimony. Alongside of that, House Democrats have also been making a ton of requests for things like Trump Organization financial documents, right? Trump's personal financial records, things like that. And the Trump administration has sued to block those subpoenas. And this week just lost all those lawsuits. So that all culminated yesterday in this meeting that Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer were supposed to go to the White House to have about infrastructure funding. And what ended up happening is that the staff of the White House had kind of very quietly called a press conference and had a bunch of reporters milling around in the Rose Garden. And right before the meeting started, they ran a podium out there with a bunch of signs. And then Trump walks into this meeting and rants for 3 minutes about how people are investigating him and that's unfair, and then storms out and walks right to the podium and does a press conference. It was very clearly planned and very clumsily so.
The best one is the one that happened today, though. It was even better.
What? Which thing?
This is the one where he repeated the line where that he was a stable genius.
Oh, yes.
Right. It's like, literally, like, what would be more strange? Just, like, saying, like, if you have to tell people you're stable, it's like...
I'll tell you right now, if someone walked up to me on the street and went, you know, I'm a stable genius.
I would say you're not.
Feet and trying to watch where their hands are, right? Like...
No, not only did really he call himself a stable genius, he then called on three people. One of them was like Kellyanne Conway, and then the lady that's always mad that does his press conferences.
Huckabee Sanders,
and then somebody else. And then made them talk about the meeting with Pelosi, and he made them say like how calm he was and how like, you know, calm of a president he was.
So there's a lot that's going on right now. There is definitely a thread in this in which the administration is trying to block investigations because they're freaked out about what those investigations will find. That is obviously what's going on. That's at least a part of it. Part of it seems to be that Trump is trying to present himself as being really strong in the face of unjust congressional investigation or whatever. So there's obviously a thread of that. I think there's definitely a thread in which he is very paranoid about people knowing stuff about his personal life. And that has always been the case. Like, that's not new. He's been that way since the 80s. And part of his sort of crafting of persona is about obfuscating those kind of details about his life, right?
But let me just ask, I mean, like, okay, so they don't want people to know stuff. I mean, understandably. But I mean, like, what exactly could be uncovered that would actually mean anything? I mean, like, because so far it's like we've just seen like shocking revelations, like oh my god, like Donald Trump lies and he sucks and he's like a rich piece of shit. It's like, you know, news at 11. But I mean, is there any dirt that could be uncovered that would actually physically, like, I guess legally hurt him or something?
So the big possibility from the documents that were ordered to be turned over this week, and which TD Bank and Deutsche Bank very voluntarily are going to turn over because they don't want to deal with Trump any more than anyone else does, is that there's possible financial fraud involved. And that financial fraud involves the $2 billion of loans that Deutsche Bank gave to Donald Trump over the years. In that period of time, like, they funded a lot of what happened in Atlantic City, for example. A lot of his casinos in Atlantic City went bankrupt, and he actually defaulted on $600 million worth of loans from Deutsche Bank, from their business banking division. So he applied for another loan right after that default and got turned down. But then what he did is he contacted another division of Deutsche Bank and applied for the loan, but with different numbers and different valuations, and got the loan. Now, the problem is that because those numbers were different, he lied on one or the other of those loan applications. And Michael Cohen admitted as such. And he is partially serving his jail sentence because of lying on financial documents and loan applications. And so by getting the Deutsche Bank records, that could be potentially provable. And if it's proven that Donald Trump signed off on those papers, that is serious financial fraud. And financial fraud that would put someone in prison for 10 to 20 years, as well as, you know, invalidate, you know, potentially lead to the dechartering of his companies and stuff, and the liquidation of assets. And so it's not at with the Deutsche Bank documents, it's not even about wealth and the perception of wealth. There literally is the possibility of uncovering significant financial fraud. And he's clearly freaking out about that, especially because it's been rumored that that happened for at least a decade at this point. There's been a rumor out there that is what occurred. Deutsche Bank itself doesn't have a great history when it comes to financial fraud either, in that they have also, in numerous points throughout their recent history, had to pay multi-million-dollar fines to various different governments for, you know, fraudulently filing financial records, falsifying financial records, especially when it comes to loans to very wealthy private business people like Donald Trump. So that's part of it. I think part of it is that he's freaking out about the congressional testimony, because once someone starts to testify, especially when you're talking about someone like Don McGahn, who doesn't really like Donald Trump or work in the White House anymore or whatever, they have everything to lose by lying and everything to gain by telling the whole story. And someone like Don McGahn, for example, specifically in the Mueller report, talked about in his testimony to the special prosecutor's office that he was ordered by Donald Trump on numerous occasions to fire Robert Mueller. And if that's true, that is at least conspiracy to conduct obstruction of justice, and that is an impeachable offense. So what Congress would need is they would need evidence of that to present in potential impeachment proceedings. And what Trump is doing is trying to block that evidence from getting to Congress in order to jam up those impeachment proceedings. What's ironic about that is that in reality, the Democrats probably don't have that much motivation to try and impeach Donald Trump right now.
No, I don't think they do at all.
Again, there's a good reason for that, right? Because they're going to lose in the Senate. And if they lose in the Senate and he doesn't get formally impeached by the Senate, that reinforces Trump's narrative of him being a victim in an unjust investigation.
Well, not only that, but I mean, I think they kind of need him to just continue to suck.
There's definitely that too.
To just, like, you know, be like, look at him, he sucks. Like, vote for us. I mean, that's like the one thing they have going for them.
Yes.
Well, let me ask you this. So, I mean, let's put aside the idea that he's going to be impeached. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think that the state, you know, the state, quote unquote, as if it's a single entity, you know, wants that to happen. I think that, you know, it'd rather Trump, like, run its course and just kind of gracefully leave the stage of history, which we'll see if that happens. But I mean, like, let's say Trump loses, you know, he's not impeached. Like, once he goes back to just being a billionaire douchebag, like, is it theoretically possible that he will face charges of some sort for whatever?
Yes.
And who would actually bring those on?
So there's really two questions here. The first question is, what happens shy of impeachment, right? And there's a really interesting answer to that. And that is that one of the things that's happened this week is that support amongst Democrats in the House to create a commission to investigate the possibility of impeachment, right, an exploratory committee, has increased dramatically. And numerous House Democrats have started talking about creating such a committee. If they were to do that, if they were to start an impeachment investigation, which doesn't mean that they're filing charges of impeachment, right? They're just starting an investigation. They gain all kinds of legal powers by doing that. So they gain increased subpoena powers. They gain increased ability to impose and enforce those subpoenas as well, right? And so there's this kind of discussion going on right now, clearly amongst the Democratic caucus in the House, about whether or not they gain anything by just starting an investigation into impeachment, but not actually going through with it. And that became a lot more likely this week because Trump is trying to stonewall everything. And so I would be very surprised if in the next week or two we don't see something like that start. And at that point, kind of the floodgates open for the information we would get. And this kind of leads to the question you asked, what happens to that information? Well, once it gets entered into congressional record, if it's not classified, anyone has access to that, including prosecutors in the Southern District of New York, which really where it seems a lot of this is going is that the Financial Crimes Division of the Southern District of New York Federal Court and the Manhattan DA's office are both investigating financial crimes related to Donald Trump. They will be drawing off whatever evidence is gathered during these congressional proceedings they can get their hands on in the public record as a part of that investigation. And so if Trump leaves office, there's a really good chance that he might get indicted. And if he doesn't get indicted, there's at least going to be some level of legal sanction, even if it's civil, that will occur. And that will all happen in either the Southern District of New York or the Manhattan DA's office. What's interesting about that separation, though, is that the Southern District of New York is a federal court. If Trump were to be indicted there, whoever his successor is, if they chose to do this, could pardon him. But if the Manhattan DA's office charges him, they can't, because it's a state-level court that the federal government really doesn't have any control over. Right. And so the most likely path right now seems to be that there's going to be investigations all the way up to the election. Right. The election's going to happen. And then depending on what happens in the election, charges could be filed in either the Manhattan DA, like local court in Manhattan, or in the Southern District of New York federal court, depending on who wins that election. Right. So if Trump wins that election, charges will be filed in Manhattan potentially right away. If a Democrat wins the election, they might file those charges federally. But there's a lot of legal strategy that has to go into that. But there's a really solid chance that either Donald Trump and or any number of his children will end up being indicted for financial fraud, just based on what we already know. It's pretty demonstrable at this point.
It's my dream. Just see the kids in chains.
Yeah, I mean, no one should ever go to prison, but like,
Donald Trump's children.
Yeah. There's only 4 inmates in the entire United States. The long and short of this is that I think what we gain out of this, as people who aren't necessarily super interested in the question of impeachment, what we gain out of this is we gain a bit of an insight.
And sorry to interrupt, but just to be clear, I mean, if Trump leaves, I mean, Pence is there.
Yeah, Pence is there, and, like, the state still continues, right? Like,
right, yeah.
The ultimate change doesn't actually happen, right? Like, the anarchist project doesn't get brought to culmination because Donald Trump gets impeached.
Sure, my point is that, I mean, I feel like at this point, I mean, Pence would be, like, a dream for half of these people.
Sure, well, and impeachment does one more thing, which is entirely detrimental to what we're trying to achieve here, which is that it creates the image that we're restoring things back to normality and that normality is okay.
Right.
And you've seen this a lot in the, you know, endless amounts of people that openly wish for Barack Obama to still be president, right?
Right.
Really, what they're wishing for is a return back to the normality that we had before Donald Trump was president. But we have to also think, like, that world also really sucked, right? Like, it wasn't that great. And so Trump getting impeached, or, you know, everyone in the White House, like, disappearing tomorrow because the rapture happened or whatever, doesn't actually fundamentally change much of anything. Right. It restores things back to a balance that existed pre-Donald Trump. And that's not necessarily great. But what we can get out of this, though, is I think 2 things. The first is that through this kind of internecine warfare that's going on inside the state right now, the U.S. state is dramatically weakened. Politically, they're weakened on an international level. They're weakened economically. They're actually incredibly vulnerable at this moment to losing their position of hegemony globally, even more than they already have. And that creates a total shift in our political context, right? That we need to be paying very careful attention to the features of, because it's going to have a lot of impacts about on how we do things as we go forward. So it can provide that weakening effect. And that weakening effect in itself has a lot of value. But I think the other thing that we gain is we can start to understand some level of the machinations of how the international banking system works, how big businesses borrow, and how the machinations of the state work when they're trying to restore things back to normality. And all of those things are incredibly crucial for us to understand because, I mean, if we're all going to be honest with ourselves, like, revolutions don't end in a day. You know, like, these are processes that will continue for years most of the time, sometimes decades. And as that happens, things will shift and change, and we need to understand the contours of those changes as we go forward. And this is a really interesting, this kind of like we were talking about earlier, this is a really fascinating moment where we're hitting a point of acute crisis. And in that moment of acute crisis, we can see things that were invisible before. And so we need to be paying attention to what's becoming visible to us that we wouldn't have been able to see, say, 2 years ago. Because those things that were invisible are actually the machinations, the logistics of state action being exposed for us to start to interrogate for the first time. And we need to be really up on that project, because that, more than anything else, is going to be a really crucial determining element to how effective we can be in the future. And if we're actually really serious about this, like, fighting the state thing, we need to be prioritizing our ability to be effective in that fight. And that does mean doing your research, and that does mean doing your reading and watching documentaries and following what's going on in politics and reading the Deutsche Bank documents and those kinds of things whenever you get an opportunity to. Because the more of that we do, the more effective that we are.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us, and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.